I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off today. Ahead this evening, a verdict comes down in the federal trial of six Philadelphia police officers. First, authorities say all the passengers and crew from Amtrak Train 188 are now accounted for. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports service won't be back to normal until next week.
Philadelphia Fire Commissioner Derek Sawyer says a specially trained dog sniffed out the remains of an eighth person killed in the crash.
We utilize our hydraulic tools to open up the train a little bit more so that we can reach the person, and we're able to extricate that person and have them transported to the medical examiner's office. Once again, this was a great coordinated effort.
Mayor Michael Nutter says the grim discovery effectively ends the days of tracking down each of the train's 243 passengers and crew.
All individuals that we had any reason to believe were on that train have now been accounted for, and we know their whereabouts.
Now the National Transportation Safety Board investigation can move ahead at full speed, along with the efforts to restore train service between New York and Philly. Amtrak CEO Joe Boardman says in addition to replacing track, crews have to replace overhead wires. He says some trains could be running again on Monday, with a full schedule more likely for Tuesday. National Transportation Safety Board officials said Wednesday this crash could have been prevented if this stretch of track had a safety system in place known as positive train control. PTC automatically slows a train going into the curve, like the one where the train derailed. Amtrak's Boardman is vowing the system will be in place soon throughout the Northeast Corridor.
And we spent $111 million getting ready for positive train control. We had to change a lot of things on the corridor to make it work. And we're very close to being able to cut it in. We need some testing done on interference with the 220 megahertz radios that we're dealing with. But we will complete this by the end of the year.
Boardman says when the PTC is in place, Amtrak will probably be the only railroad in the Western Hemisphere to have it installed. As for this crash, it could take a year to have a final report, and Philadelphia officials are not ruling out the possibility of criminal charges against the train operator. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
As cleanup continues at the site of the derailment, some wonder if the accident could have been worse, given the black tank cars visible in photos of the scene. They're the same type of cars that carry crude oil and chemicals. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on just how hard it is to find out what's in those rail cars.
Aerial photos of the crash site show black tank cars about 50 yards from the mangled Amtrak train. They looked a lot like the cars that carry crude oil throughout the city. A Conrail spokesman finally confirmed that there was no oil in those cars, but he won't say what is in them. That's proprietary information, and that's a problem, according to rail safety experts like Fred Mylar.
I've been in this field 30 years, and for the first 20 years, they said, well, Dr. Mylar, there's no federal law that says we have to give you this information. You just try to get it out of us. It's confidential business information. Get it? And then after the 9/11 attacks, they would say, well, Dr. Mylar, guess what? We can't give you this information because it's Homeland Security.
I asked the National Transportation Safety Board, the Federal Railroad Administration, the American Association of Railroads, Norfolk Southern, and the Tank Car Company what was in those rail cars. They either don't know or wouldn't say. Even the mayor's spokesman said he didn't know. And according to Mylar, oil is not the only thing to worry about.
The most dangerous object in anybody's town is the chlorine gas tank car. I mean, it's far more dangerous than crude oil, rail car by rail car. But then the railroads can ship this same chlorine tank car around the country at 70 miles an hour and don't have to tell anybody.
Throughout the region, commuter rail and Amtrak lines run parallel in many places to the dozens of oil trains rumbling into town on their way to local refineries. In fact, a Norfolk Southern oil train line crosses the Amtrak lines over the Frankfort Junction section of the tracks. Conrail spokesman John Enright says if the Amtrak train had crashed into the tank cars, first responders would have been told of the contents. I'm Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Federal prosecutors in Philadelphia today were handed a stunning defeat. After hearing more than a month of testimony, a jury acquitted six former elite police officers of 26 counts related to corruption and the abuse of power. This means the officers are set free and may even get their jobs back. WHYY's Bobby Allen has details.
As the jury foreman read the words not guilty over and over in the audience, family members of the officers were overcome with emotion, crying in each other's arms. And as everyone spilled out of the courtroom, supporters of the former cops embraced the defense attorneys with a victory slap on the back.
Great job.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Following an FBI sting, federal prosecutors indicted the officers, accusing them of planting drug evidence to win convictions and then covering it up. The defense argued that prosecutors rested their case on the word of people who can't be trusted, drug dealers, and an admitted dirty cop. A state judge reversed more than 50 convictions that arose from the work of the disgraced former cop, Jeff Walker. He pleaded guilty in a separate case, but then he became the government's star witness, testifying against six former colleagues. One of the six, John Spicer, says Walker acted alone.
There is a line that has to be drawn, and once you cross that line, then there's no coming back, which Jeff Walker did, and we did not.
We knew from the beginning of this case this is going to be a very difficult case to bring.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Anthony Zorick says despite the defeat, he doesn't regret bringing the case. He says it won't deter his office from prosecuting police corruption. On the elevator after the verdict, Samantha Betts couldn't contain her joy that her dad, Perry Betts, was acquitted.
Overwhelmed, overjoyed.
We get our dad back.
Yeah, pretty much. We get our dad back. He has a grandson, and he can finally go out and take him for a walk.
Meanwhile, the officers planned a party at the Fraternal Order of Police headquarters. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
WHYY's Steve Trader contributed to this report. Only a few days remain until the May 19th primary, when Philadelphia voters will choose a new mayor and may elect to dramatically shake up city council. WHYY reporters Kevin McCorry and Katie Colinari bring us this take on some of the newcomers trying to oust the incumbents.
All right, Katie, all 17 council seats are up for grabs in this election. 10 of those seats are for council members who represent a specific geographical district in the city.
Right, Kevin. And 7 are at-large members that the entire city can vote for. And those are the seats we're going to talk about today.
So to just focus on the Democrats, if that's your affiliation, on primary day, you'll get to choose 5 candidates from a long list of incumbents and newcomers. The incumbents are Wilson Good Jr., Bill Greenlee, Blondell Reynolds Brown, and Ed Nielsen. Based on name recognition and connections to power brokers, incumbents typically win. But in this race, at least one newcomer will take a seat. Why?
And today, this campaign starts for mayor.
Jim Kenney retired his at-large seat to run for mayor, so there's a guaranteed opening.
But there's actually been a big TV ad blitz to shake up council completely. Here's a clip from an ad paid for by the dark money group Philly 3.0.
More council members have been arrested, died, or fleeced us with a drop pension grab than have retired. Isn't it time to turn the page on these people?
So in addition to the 4 incumbents, there are 12 newcomers vying for a spot. Of those, 8 are considered to have a shot based on money raised and name recognition. So let's start with Helen Gim. She's a grassroots public education advocate, a former teacher, a charter school founder. She knows the ins and outs of city schools probably as well as anybody and has gotten props from the White House for her work. She has the backing and the big cash that comes with it from the teachers union. And she's also raised more money in small donations than any candidate this year, including in the mayor's race. Of all the candidates for city council, she's the only one who's pushed a specific plan to immediately raise the new revenue that the school district says it needs to start next year.
Next up, Paul Steinke. He was the general manager of Reading Terminal Market for 13 years, and in that time, he spearheaded its modernization. Steinke says he can stimulate growth in the city's struggling commercial corridors. Doing that, he says, will boost the city's tax base and provide more money for schools. Steinke's also active in the LGBT community, and he would be the first openly gay person elected to office in Philadelphia. If you take away the money that candidates have loaned themselves, Steinke's raised the most cash without having to rely on big checks from unions or political committees.
Tom Wyatt can be seen as kind of a crossover candidate.
I'm Tom Wyatt, and I'm running for city council because we're at a turning point.
He's a Center City mergers and acquisitions lawyer at Dilworth Paxson, and he used to be the chief ethics officer at American Water Works in New Jersey. But he also has credibility when it comes to schools. He's the head of the education committee for the Passyunk Square Neighbors Association, and he also plans to send his 2 young kids to Andrew Jackson Elementary in South Philly. Like Gim, Wyatt has teaching experience, having served in Teach for America in the Mississippi Delta.
And if Tom Wyatt's the crossover candidate, Sherry Cohen is the establishment candidate, since she's the only newcomer being backed by the city's Democratic Party. She's the daughter of the late Councilman David Cohen, and like Paul Steinke, Cohen's openly gay and would be the first elected to city council. She's a progressive like her father, and Cohen wants to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour and require developers to include affordable housing in new buildings.
Isaiah Thomas is the Associate Dean of Students at a Philadelphia charter school. He's also very involved in the neighborhood of Frankfurt, where he runs a free basketball camp and other mentoring programs. He ran for city council actually in 2011 at age 26 and lost, but he's back now at 31. He's earned the support of several powerful backers, including many city unions. He sees himself as a representative of middle-class black Philadelphia who's grown up in what he calls a climate of stop and frisk.
Alan Dom is a big-time city real estate developer who's raised nearly $1 million for his campaign, by far more than any other candidate. Half of it has come from his own wallet, which allowed him to pound the television airwaves.
A Philadelphia success story. Alan Dom.
Dom vows to donate his council salary to the school district and says he's got a vigorous plan to collect the city's delinquent taxes to fund education. He also wants to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour.
Frank Rizzo Jr. is trying to get back on city council after a stint from 1995 to 2011 as a Republican. His father, of course, was mayor in the 1970s. Now Rizzo Jr. is back running as a Democrat. His previous tenure was largely based on constituent services, like getting day-to-day things done for people in the neighborhoods, right? Rizzo lost this spot on council due in large part to his participation in a perk where city workers can retire for a day and receive a lump sum pension payout.
And finally, Derek Green is the longtime special counsel to retiring Councilwoman Marion Tasco. While he was on Tasco's staff, he helped write legislation, including her bill to help curb predatory lending. Green says his strong acquaintance with the city budget will help him find ways to move dollars to the school district. He also wants to boost support for students with special needs, like his son, who was diagnosed with autism.
There are four other newcomers vying for an at-large seat. To read about them and see further detail of the ones we mentioned, visit newsworks.org.
You can hear much more of our primary election coverage on the third installment of our series, Leading Questions, tomorrow morning at 11. Taking a look at today's headlines, Philadelphia Democratic mayoral candidate Jim Kenney picked up a valuable endorsement today when City Council President Daryl Clark gave him his former council colleague his blessing at North Philadelphia news conference.
And when I hear somebody tells me they're going to be a block-by-block mayor, and they've exhibited the willingness to do that, I think that it is clear that I need to be with that particular person.
Clark also says he likes Kenny's support for public employee unions. A poll released yesterday shows Kenny with a commanding lead in the race. The New Jersey Assembly today approved a bill setting up a legal framework that would regulate gestational surrogates. It now goes to Governor Chris Christie's desk. The bill authorizes agreements between intended parents and women who would carry the pregnancy but would not be genetically related to the infant. It outlines requirements for prospective surrogates and obligations for the intended parents. Christie vetoed the same bill in 2012. At the time, he said the measure raises serious and significant issues. The WHYY forecast, mostly clear with a low around 52 degrees tonight. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high around 75. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a chance of late night showers and a low near 60 degrees. Saturday, partly sunny with a chance of rain and a high near 85. And Sunday, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high near 85 degrees. It's 70 degrees in Wilmington, Delaware, and 72 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia at 6:18. Still ahead, the Philadelphia Singers take their final bow this weekend after 43 years of choral performance.
It's sort of like walking around with a knot in your stomach because it's been such a part of my life for so long. I mean, I'm sad. A lot of the emotions one would expect when something you love dies.
That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues.
Thirty antique dealers from across the nation will be featured at the Brandywine River Museum of Art Antique Show on Memorial Day weekend, May 23rd through the 25th. This event presents a variety of American and English furniture, glass, metalware, ceramics, folk art, quilts, rugs, and more. All museum galleries will be open, displaying art by N.C., Andrew, and Jamie Wyeth. Details at brandywinemuseum.org. The Brandywine River Museum supports WHYY.
You can hear the difference between Mad Max Fury Road and the original Mad Max movies from years ago.
You want to get through this? Do as I say.
I was very interested in a female road warrior. And here she is, a character exactly equivalent to Max.
Mad Max meets his match. Also, a look at the diverse casts of next season's TV shows. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
Proudly supporting WHYY is New Jersey's Clean Energy Program. Educating businesses, local governments, schools, and residents how to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects. Existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing facilities with assistance from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Brad Linder in for Dave Heller. After 43 years, the Philadelphia Singers, a classical choral group, will perform a final concert this weekend. They've been a mainstay of the region's music scene, performing regularly with the Philadelphia Orchestra. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports the chorus almost didn't make it to its own farewell performance. The Philadelphia Singers are rehearsing works by Bach and a series of traditional hymns like this one for their farewell concert on Saturday. Most classical choral groups are a mixture of professional and amateur voices, but this is one of the few all-professional groups. Allison Harvey has been singing with the group for almost 25 years.
It's that strength of being able to pick up a piece of music, whatever it might be, with a group full of people who know how to run with that and how to make music and a real commitment to working with each other at a high level.
The news of the group's demise came suddenly. Harvey and the rest of the Singers were only told mid-season that this would be their last season.
It's sort of like walking around with a knot in your stomach because it's been such a part of my life for so long. I mean, I'm sad. I'm a little angry, too, that it sort of disappeared on us somewhat suddenly. I mean, I've always known that there's been difficulties. So there's that sadness. I think there are a lot of the emotions one would expect when something you love dies.
The group was started in 1972 by a young choral conductor, Michael Korn, who believed classical vocal singers should be paid just like instrumentalists. But it's been living pretty much hand-to-mouth for the last 43 years, and when a grant did not come through last year as expected, that was the end of it. Gregory Cantwell, a baritone, has been with the chorus since the very beginning.
It's a very specialized art form, choral singing. So it's always hard to get money, get funding. And that's always been one of the problems with the Singers. That was the problem that caused the death knell for us. It's really sad.
It's easy to wallow in these pieces. I don't want to wallow. I want to be expressive, but I don't want to wallow.
That is music director David Hayes, who took over after Korn died in 1991, and he's been the director ever since. But this has been a tough week for him. Just minutes after this rehearsal Tuesday, he boarded the New York-bound Amtrak train that derailed in Port Richmond, killing several and injuring hundreds. Miraculously, he walked away from the wreckage with only bruises.
Just gonna stay quiet and rest a lot in the next few days, and then I'll go into it business as usual in the sense of rehearsing and performing. I probably won't be moving quite as vigorously as I perhaps might normally conduct, but... still probably going to be a little bit sore.
The show will go on. Many of the Singers are treating the end of the group as professionals do. This is a gig that lasted a good long time, and now they have to look for more work. But some nostalgia does creep in, says that baritone, Greg Cantwell.
We worked on an encore last night, a piece by Rachmaninoff from the Rachmaninoff Vespers, and David looked a little verklempt at the end, and he said, I just wanted to hear you sing it again. So we'll give it our best.
The Philadelphia Singers will perform for the last time on Saturday night at the Church of the Holy Trinity in Rittenhouse Square. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
After that derailment of Amtrak Train 188 Tuesday night, Twitter and Facebook lit up with reactions. And reactions to the reactions, including lots of scolding from social media users, from criticizing journalists for tweeting at crash survivors to blasting professional violinist Jennifer Kim for tweeting about retrieving her instrument from the wreckage. Is the backlash appropriate during a disaster? NewsWorks producer and Speakeasy blog editor Eric Walter asked Stephen Petro, USA Today's Digital Life columnist. He's a go-to guy for questions of internet civility.
I think it's
part of a larger problem of blaming on social media, bullying on social media. It's kind of just, it just kind of taps into that vein. And, you know, in general, I don't think that ignoring them is a good idea, because they kind of take strength from this, and they build on themselves, and then these packs form. And, you know, and it kind of was a pack mentality on Twitter the other night. No, I think sometimes, you know, someone needs to come in, and as people did, and say, you know, stop, get a reality check. This is wrong. You know, focus on what you can do. Disaster relief, whatever it is. Break out of this mentality of attacking and blaming for everything.
For Eric Walter's entire interview with Digital Life columnist Stephen Petro, go to newsworks.org/speakeasy. On a more upbeat note, Kevin McCrory's story about Webster Elementary School opening its doors to victims, emergency workers, and worried families after the Amtrak crash moved many of our readers and listeners. On Facebook, reader Lois Lamond said she used to teach with Principal Sean Wright and called him a class person. Amy Myers called Wright a wonderful and caring man. And Anne Charles Siparek wrote, "Way to go, Webster and people of Kensington. What a nightmare to have to be part of. Thank God you folks were there." Read more and join the conversation at Newsworks Facebook page. Finally this evening, teachers are accustomed to prepping for different settings, taking class size into consideration. But how do you go about it when most weeks you have, say, 20 students, and then once a year, the group swells to 100-fold?
This week is particularly exciting for me because of the beauty of getting all those people together. There's 1,900 people registered. My name is Jennifer Schulter, and I'm the co-founder of Yoga on the Steps. And I work as an independent yoga teacher, meditation teacher. Yoga on the Steps is a vision that I had 15 years ago for people of all ages and stages and everyone to enjoy themselves by moving and feeling healthy and enjoying themselves on the Art Museum steps. I took that dream to living beyond breast cancer, for sharing that with women who are going through treatment, as well as their families and anybody that would like to empower themselves and feel healthy. So it really opens it up to a wider audience. I write out all the ideas that I have for this event. So when it comes to delivering the class, I already know, very similarly to a comedian or to anyone that has to speak in front of people, what I'm going to say. However, that being said, I leave it loose enough that I don't cling to the script. And then I let it unfold more as an improvisation, because you never know when a bird might fly through or somebody may say something. And so it's more interacted, like improv.
Kimberly Haas produced our recap with yoga instructor Jennifer Schulter. Yoga on the Steps, a benefit for the organization Living Beyond Breast Cancer, will take place Sunday morning on the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. You can hear about the work week of others in our region at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Dave Heller returns tomorrow evening. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll continue our survey of the race for at-large seats in Philadelphia City Council with a look at the Republican side of the ballot. And don't forget the third installment of our special election coverage, Leading Questions, tomorrow morning at 11. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for Newsworks Tonight.
The Rosenbach supports WHYY and presents Everything Is Going On Brilliantly, Oscar Wilde in Philadelphia, an exhibition celebrating Wilde's indelible legacy, on view now through May 24th. Highlights include unpublished works on display for the very first time, new bits of verse, a letter from Wilde to his idol, Walt Whitman, and the earliest published version of The Picture of Dorian Gray. Steps from Rittenhouse Square, the Rosenbach is open Tuesday through Sunday. Details at rosenbach.org.